Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 731, interview with John Loftus about America's Nazi secret. This program is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2010. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves John Loftus, former Justice Department investigator and the author of, in its old form, The Belarus Secret, The Secret War Against the Jews, Unholy Trinity, the last two co-authored with Mark Ahrens, The Witness Tree, and most recently published in soft cover by Trine Day Publishers, America's Nazi Secret. John, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Over the years, finally, the veil of censorship/secrecy has fallen still more from some of the things, not only the things that you've been investigating, but from the investigations that you've conducted themselves. And for people that have followed your work over the years, there are things in America's Nazi Secret about just exactly what it is that you've been contending with in order to bring us all this information for these this long period of time.
You know, Dave, it's funny. 30 years ago, when I wrote The Belarus Secret, the Justice Department and other agencies censored the heck out of it. And now, 30 years later, I'm free to write about it. And they've sort of walked into their own trap. They wouldn't have censored this stuff out of my book 30 years ago unless it was true. And now they can't deny it. It's funny, my book came out on Veterans Day in November, and 3 days later, the Justice Department leaked a 600-page report to the New York Times, apologizing, justifying their efforts, and admitting that, in fact, the U.S. government, did recruit some Nazis, and we might have lied about some stuff to the courts. But the idea was that before a single review could be written about my book, they wanted to get their story out and plead to the misdemeanor because they knew I was going to charge them with the felony. There are people in the Justice Department who belong in prison. They lied to Congress. They orchestrated one fraud after another. And this isn't just, one little episode. This is something that goes back to the 1920s, mm-hmm. when the Justice Department was protecting those great American families who funded Hitler.
John, on that note, why don't we begin setting the events? Now, obviously, we've spoken about a fair amount of this in previous programs, but for people that are new, and in order to understand why the Justice Department would go to extraordinary lengths, and not just the Justice Department, but other institutions to cover this up, why don't we take a look at just what it was they were covering up, and beyond that, who it was that was doing what they were covering up. John, do you think it would be fair to describe the Webb-Pomeroy Act and the actions of the robber barons at the end of World War I as either a manifestation of or perhaps the beginning of what we think of as globalization?
Oh, that's so true. When President Teddy Roosevelt banned monopolies, trusts, and cartels in America, the Webb-Pomeroy Act of 1918 allowed American corporations, the robber barons of Wall Street, to set up monopolies, trusts, and cartels overseas. So these crooked companies bought three countries. They funded the infant Nazi Party of Germany, the infant Bolshevik Party of Russia, and what became the House of Saud. Basically, they funded three terrorist groups to take control of three countries that would allow them to set up their monopolies, trusts, and cartels.
John, let's give us some of the nomenclature, some of the people, and some of the venerable institutions in this country that are the perps of the things you're going to describe.
Yeah, this is both Republicans and Democrats. And the Democrats, everybody knows about Joe Kennedy, but they don't know that Joe Kennedy bought his Nazi stock from Prescott Bush. Okay? Prescott Bush's father-in-law, Herbert Walker, was the evil genius that put this stuff together. The Harrimans were the great Democratic family. They funded the Bolsheviks, and they put together a deal with Walker, the Rockefellers, the Bushes, to set up joint operations. They would have, because of the money they pumped in the early Bolshevik Party, they had sort of a monopoly of Russian raw material exports. And because of the money that the Bushes, the Walkers, the Rockefellers, the DuPonts had pumped into Germany, they had a monopoly on the German high-tech patent stuff. So they wanted to build an industrial park. Because of the difference in the rail lines, it had to be, in eastern Poland near the Russian border, because the rail gauges were different. And the idea was to bring in Russian raw material by rail and then by barge. So they actually had dug the canals to the industrial park. And then the Germans would build a big factory to extract additives from coal, things that could be used for Russian aviation fuel additives. Now, so they had to have a place near a big coal mine. That was the province of Silesia, on the Vistula River, where the canals could be dug, and near the Russian border. So they picked the little Polish village of Auschwitz. And, America's finest families helped work with the Russians to build Auschwitz as a profit center. People like Harriman claim that, we got out of it as soon as the war began. Not true. Harriman filed proxy statements to keep control of the company during the war. The Silesian American Coal Company was run by none other than Prescott Bush, the father of the 41st president and grandfather of 43. These were despicable people. They made a profit on both sides of World War II. The only thing they had going for them was their lawyers. The Dulles brothers were brilliant lawyers who covered up their clients' Nazi investments. And they got away with it. I had secret files turned over as late as 1971. The Rockefeller's Bank, the Chase Manhattan Bank, owned 38% of the ThyssenKrupp Corporation, the largest and wealthiest conglomerate in Europe. Both Thyssen and Krupp were convicted Nazi war criminals. Both were clients of the Dulleses.
Of course, the Thyssen
worked out really well.
Thyssen's business partners were George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, as we've discussed in the past.
Yeah.
So with Webb Pomeroy, basically, the antitrust acts of 1913 and Teddy Roosevelt were circumvented. And one of the things that you talk about in American Nazi Secrets, and I think America's Nazi Secret, excuse me, and something that with the economic peril we all find ourselves in, I think rings in a very powerful way, and that is that the role of the reinvestment of American capital under Webb Pomeroy abroad and with the collapse of Wall Street and the onset of the Great Depression.
Sure, all the American investment capital was going out to Germany, Russia, and Saudi Arabia.
And again, I think, globalization is something that most of us think of as a recent phenomenon, but it is not. And the events that we're talking about, again, I think could be understood as a direct manifestation of what we think of as globalization.
Right. You have to understand how it began. And what the Wall Street robber barons knew was that you couldn't buy the U.S. government, but you could rent the Justice Department. Even at the Versailles Conference of World War I, the Attorney General of the United States was the bag man for the Dulles brothers and paying bribes to the other negotiators to make sure that American businessmen got a favored status in the World War I treaties. So it was all about money. I mean, these guys funded the Bolsheviks at the same time they funded the Nazis. They really didn't care much about ideology. All they cared about was profit.
One of the things that you talk about, too, and this is something that we don't hear very much about at all, much like the Webb Pomeroy Act, and that it was a patent consortium in Dusseldorf in which the key industrial patents were basically going to be controlled by this same cabal of robber baron industrialists / financiers.
Yeah, they were going to control the world through interlocking patent agreements and lock out all other competitors, because Germany had sort of a high-tech monopoly in those days. It's hard to imagine now, but if you wanted to be a scientist, you'd better learn German, because that was the language in which science was written, and which all patents, particularly chemical patents, were controlled. The Dusseldorf Patent Conference of 1939 was going to be the way that the Wall Street robber barons took over the world economically, and it was only the advent of World War II that stopped them from doing it.
Alan Dulles and his partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, John Foster Dulles, had much to do with investing Wall Street money in the Nazis. And also, one of the things you've written about in several books, including America's Nazi Secret, and that is the role of this same cabal of powerful white shoe lawyers and law firms and the robber barons in helping to set up the Muslim Brotherhood and the ultimate oxymoron, modern Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, people don't realize that they hired a radical group of Arab terrorists called the Wahhabis, after their religion, and armed them and they Americans wanted to break the back of the British monopoly on the Arabian Peninsula. They wanted to get oil. So they funded the terrorist group. The terrorist group threw the legitimate rulers of Mecca and Medina out, the Hashemite family, and then they called themselves the House of Saud. And the first thing the Saudis did, of course, was to get rid of the radical members of the Muslim Brotherhood. They weren't stupid, after all. And the next thing they did was to create Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company. So it was all about the money. So we funded the most bigoted, the most anti-Islamic group of racists on the planet just so we could get an oil monopoly in a little tiny corner of the Arab Peninsula.
For some younger and newer listeners, if a lot of this seems far-fetched, just consider on the contemporary landscape, China, which certainly is not democratic in any way. It's the one large, quote, communist, unquote, state around. And yet, paradoxically, it's become, in many ways, the bastion of international capitalism. So people should think about it. Of course, what they find attractive is the fact that you can't talk back to management in China.
Yeah, I think, you know,
their human resources department is extremely one-sided.
Well, you know, and that's how the robber barons looked at the Nazis. They didn't really like the Nazi party. They actually favored the Catholic and the conservative, the monarchist parties in Germany. Hitler was a dog on a chain, just somebody. They funded the Nazis to keep the communists and the trade unions down. Their inside man was Hitler's finance minister, Helmut Schacht, born in Brooklyn, close friend of the Wall Street robber barons. But when Hitler surprisingly became chancellor, the first thing that he did was to ban foreign ownership of German companies because he knew that the Wall Street robber barons weren't his buddies. So that forced the Wall Street robber barons to buy secret control of Swiss banks, which owned German banks. The German banks owned the stock of German corporations. The German corporations owned the patents, and the merry game continued. So that's why the Swiss passed the Swiss Bank Secrecy Act of 1933. To allow the Wall Street robber barons to continue their economic domination of the Third Reich. 70% of the money that went to finance Hitler came out of Wall Street.
In Unholy Trinity, you and your co-author Mark Ahrens have also written about the powerful Vatican participation. And there's something you talk about in America's Nazi Secret as well, something that serves as a bookend of sorts, I think, conceptually, particularly for younger listeners. Of course, you've written and we've spoken in the past about Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm that Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles used to invest money for the Nazis, including on behalf of the Bush family. Sullivan and Cromwell to this day is a general counsel for Saudi Bin Laden Group. One of the outcroppings of the doings of the robber barons in the Arabian Peninsula. John, I'd like to go into, as we develop this story, exactly what you encountered. The Ballara secret is something that I read decades ago, and it's familiar up to a point with the veteran listeners. And yet you talk about what it took to bring not only the Ballara secret, but your 60-minute segment to the light of day, which was no mean feat. Let's set some background, though, to some of the events that you were investigating, because a lot of this is just not known to people. Belarus, or White Ruthenia, or Bielorussia. What is that? And if you could set forth some of the tangled history of that region vis-a-vis the Ukraine and Poland and Russia and the Soviet Union, because it's factored in the tangled history of all of those places.
Yeah. Bielorussia was a little borderland area. For several centuries, the Tsars of Russia had allowed it to be a settlement area. It was a 70-mile-wide strip of land along the Russian border where Jews were allowed to live because they were commercially important to Russia. And some of the cities and towns going from Lithuania down through Belarusia were 90% Jewish. And they were wiped out during World War II. I mean, they were just absolutely destroyed. The Holocaust has been severely undercounted because they never had access to the Soviet archives until recently. Elie Wiesel, when he looked at my book, The Belarus Secret, was astounded. He didn't even know that there were Jewish communities of that size in that area. So the Belarusians, for geographical reasons, were the only land bridge between Europe and Russia. It was the traditional invasion route from every army from Napoleon on upwards. So the Belarusians collaborated with the Nazis, and they became pets. They were one of the few occupied countries to have their own Nazi puppet government, very high status, and they reduced the population of their own country from 10 million to 7 million. Mass murderers, their atrocities were so cruel that German soldiers testified against them at Nuremberg. One guy named Dr. Stankovich was an educated man, a doctor of humanities. He invented the sardine method of execution. His local policemen would round up the Jews and take them out to the ditches, have the Jews lay on top of each other head to toe so they could shoot through a double layer of bodies and save ammunition. A layer of dirt was shoveled over the wounded, a double layer of bodies, and so on. The worst part about the sardine method was when American Red Cross doctors were conducting autopsies after the war, they couldn't find any trace of wounds upon the smallest victims. Apparently, to save the price of a bullet, Dr. Stankovich ordered that the babies be buried alive. This revolted the SS troops. It was like saying that you gagged a maggot. People were crawling out of the graves alive. But the Belarusians were slavishly devoted to the Nazi cause. And I didn't know about this. I was just a young career Justice Department attorney, volunteered to work on this Nazi war crimes unit for a little while. And when I was down the classified vaults, I came across the diary of a Jew. And here was a guy who had fought with the Jewish partisans. I don't know if you've seen that movie Defiance that came out.
I personally haven't, though. I know people that haven't very much liked it.
Yeah, the last scene of that movie has a photograph of the actual partisans, and my friend Saul is in the front row, second from the right. So Saul wrote this history of how he fought against the Nazis and the communists and came to America to find freedom. He didn't know it, but he ended up living less than a half an hour away from the men that murdered his family, because the British Secret Service had dumped virtually the entire Nazi puppet government of Belarusia in the town of South River, New Jersey.
John, before we actually get into the Belarus Brigade and their diaspora to the United States and elsewhere, the Einsatzgruppen, what were they, and what accounted for their penchant for recruiting locals? Because the history of the Einsatzgruppen and some of the academics whom we're going to talk about is inextricably linked with that phenomenon.
The Einsatzgruppen were special action groups. They were most often called the mobile killing units. In the beginning, after Dr. Stankovich's fiasco, the SS would control the shooting at the pits, and the Belarusians would line the roads to herd the Jews in, and because the Belarusian shooters were too drunk all the time, and it was causing chaos. And then they moved to the next step, which was gas vans. They were little black trucks, and the exhaust pipes were routed to the interior. That didn't work out too well, because the people were literally clawing the metal in their attempts to get out. And so that evolved to the next step of gas chambers. But Belarusia became the first experiment in the Holocaust. Here was a population absolutely enthusiastic about supporting Hitler's goal of ridding the world of Jews. And it's no surprise that when Auschwitz was built as the industrial park as a robber baron, the same geographical factors led for it to become a killing factory as well.
John, in setting the background to how you came to be investigating these characters as a Justice Department investigator, some names familiar to the older listeners, but again, maybe not to younger and newer listeners. Who was Reinhard Gehlen, and how does he factor into the scenario that we're setting forth here?
Reinhard Gehlen was a German general who was chief of German intelligence on the Eastern Front, and he knew all of these collaborators in Belarus and the Ukraine top to bottom. At the end of World War II, the Dulles brothers recruited General Gehlen, brought him to Washington, D.C., and said, hey, look, he's our hero. He's the guy that's going to recruit gigantic network of freedom fighters behind Russian lines. And the British Secret Service was saying, yeah, we would do it, but we don't have the money. So Gehlen was endorsed by the British chief, whose name was Kim Philby. Philby, of course, was the highest-ranking Soviet spy ever to penetrate the British Secret Service. Philby's mission was to get the gullible Americans to take in all the East European Nazis to use as agents in the Cold War, because they were people that the Russians could blackmail. Instead of freedom fighters, we got the dregs of the war criminals. It was a terrible fiasco. And the worst thing was that our State Department and my own agency, the Justice Department, covered it up. I guess you'd have to go back. Remember the Truman-Dewey race, the famous newspaper headline,
sure.
Dewey wins?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dewey's campaign manager in New York was Alan Dulles. And Dulles had been promised by Dewey as soon as he won, Dulles would head up a new agency to be called the CIA. Dulles had already started hiring his buddy. Dulles's idea was to cover up his client's Nazi investments under a shroud of national security. Big problem when Truman got reelected. So for a while there, we actually had two CIAs, one that worked for the President Truman and the Democratic Party, and the other, called the Office of Policy Coordination, OPC, that worked for the Republicans and Alan Dulles. And for 4 years, we had two CIAs in America, one that hunted Nazis, one that recruited them. And things got worse when Eisenhower was elected, because Eisenhower put the Dulles brothers in charge of everything. One brother became head of CIA, the other became head of the State Department. And they just turned the faucet and let the Nazi war criminals come into America by the droves. Now, the worst thing they did was to bring in the Arab Nazis. And boy, there's a scandal and a half.
Well, that one, of course, is very much on the front burner today. The Muslim Brotherhood and some of those connections are something I'd like to get into, and primarily inside, too. John, before we develop further the Galen Organization and the OPC and Frank Wisner and the people you were tracking down through OSI, the bankers' trial and what Franklin Roosevelt was hoping to do, the people who were in the dustbin, so to speak, in Germany,
good question.
Alan Dulles and how he managed to circumvent that.
Well, my first boss at this new Nazi hunting unit that President Carter set up was a guy who had been one of the banker's prosecutors at Nuremberg. His name was Walter Rockler. He's now passed away. But Walter told me that the Nuremberg trials were fixed, that something had gone on. And so my secret assignment from him was to find out what had happened, who had fixed the Nuremberg trials, and why. And, you know, what I found out was this whole history of you know, the Wall Street robber barons and how they got involved. So it was, I wore two hats. Officially, I was investigating Belarusian Nazis in America, but they were just a case study and a cover-up for my real job, which is to find out, you know, how the American investors got their money into Nazi Germany and got it out again. The Dulles brothers had absolutely prostituted the interests of America worldwide in making alliances during the Eisenhower administration with the worst dregs of dictators in the world. Anyone that would continue the robber baron strategy of giving Americans economic dominance, monopolies, cartels. It ruined America's image overseas, and we ended up bringing in some of the worst people in the world in this country, people that worked for the Soviets. You know, the Cold War dragged on for so many years because the Russians knew everything that we were doing. There was actually a fatality rate of 98% of the agents that CIA sent behind the Iron Curtain. For years, they censored that out of my book for fear that it would discourage recruitment in the future. It kind of had a point.
Franklin Roosevelt and the bankers' trial, what was he hoping to do, and how did Dulles circumvent that?
Oh, yeah, good point. Well, what Roosevelt wanted to do was to use the bankers' trial to have the German bankers point the fingers at their American partners. And then that would cause a public outcry, and Roosevelt could put the American robber barons on trial for aiding the Nazis for treason, giving aid and comfort to the enemy of in time of war is treason. And Roosevelt had more than the two witnesses the Constitution required. He had hundreds of witnesses. In fact, there were 150 Americans who had worked with inside the Third Reich all during the war on behalf of American companies. And Dulles had to hide them. So they set up a special prison camp called Ashcan Dustbin after the war. And they hid the Americans, traitors, who work for the American companies, and that camp. And eventually the Justice Department quietly released them all and brought them home. Not a single American was ever tried for treason, for helping Hitler before, during, and after the war, when they smuggled the Nazi money in.
And basically, the names responsible for this malfeasance, for the crimes of the Third Reich, or at least some of the crimes of the former Soviet Union, and the depredations of the Muslim Brotherhood offshoots like Al-Qaeda and Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a lot of the responsibility for that it falls with our own industrial and financial elite.
Yeah, and not the whole elite, but just 4 or 5% of American corporations. And the Eisenhower administration was their heyday. Eisenhower was put into office by the Dulles brothers. They made him president of Columbia University, and they arranged money for his campaigns. And he was not a good guy. Eisenhower knew a lot of this covert stuff was going on. I don't think that Eisenhower knew about the American investors in Nazi Germany. But that was the point, was that the Rockefellers had to be protected. And in return, the Rockefellers would finance whichever Republican candidates the Dulles brothers picked.
And basically, at the end of the war, the Americans at Ashcan Dustbin simply walked.
Yeah. The Justice Department let them go. You know, the Justice Department of lawyers. You know, a lot of these guys would, you know, work for a while for justice and then go for a nice career with the Wall Street firms. And, the Justice Department sold us out.
John, we've got about 2 minutes on this side, maybe a little bit less. In reading about the Galen Organization and the importation of many of these Nazi functionaries, the people you've been investigating, I would come across something, and I could never figure out whether it was part of the State Department or the CIA. And after reading your books, I understand why I was so confused. We've only got a little over a minute, but let's introduce a topic we'll get into inside, too, the Office of Policy Coordination. What was that?
Well, this was a covert unit. President Truman thought the CIA should only collect intelligence and not get involved in covert operations. The State Department, Office of Policy Coordination, was involved with paramilitary operations, psychological warfare operations. They were hiring ex-Nazis for assassination programs behind the Iron Curtain. And, for example, the Ukrainian version of the Gestapo, the SB, the Shlujba Bezpa. Those guys were responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of Ukrainians and Poles and Jews. They murdered Simon Wiesenthal's mother. There was a letter from Frank Wisner at the State Department to the Justice Department saying, okay, look, these guys are coming into the U.S. illegally, but just keep quiet about it because they've assassinated 35,000 Russians behind the Iron Curtain. And they're important for our covert ops. And justice went along with it. In fact, the Attorney General of the United States sponsored Mykola Lebed personally, the head of the SB for immigration. And years later, when I blew the whistle before Congress, I didn't know it. But the Justice Department lied and said Mykola Lebed was a leader of the anti-Nazi resistance in the Ukraine.
Another manifestation of the big lie. John, we are almost out of time on Sod 1. I'd like to get back to Frank Wisner, another of these white shoe Wall Street lawyers and a person who figures large in America's Nazi secret. However, we are all out of time in Sod 1. This concludes Sod 1 of For the Record program number 731, interview with John Loftus about America's Nazi secret. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. This is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2010.